Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we begin the program by talking about how you can heal your body from the inside out. With me, Dr. Robin Chutkin, who is an integrative gastroenterologist, founder of the Digestive Center for Women. She's the author of Gut Bliss and The Bloat Cure. And her latest book is The Microbiome Solution, a radical new way to heal your body from the inside out. Fascinating topic, and I enjoyed the book. I hope you'll join in with your questions. Maybe changing your diet helped your health at one point. What questions do you have for Dr. Chutkin? I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go ahead and post on our Facebook page and our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And Dr. Robin Chutkin, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry. It's a pleasure.
Well, let's talk about microbes first. What is a microbiome?
The microbiome refers to all the organisms, bacteria primarily, but also parasites, viruses, fungal organisms, so all the organisms that live in and on our bodies, over 100 trillion in all.
And I think at one point, years and years back, we assumed that a lot of them were not good for us. And in fact, they do tend to work together, do they not?
Absolutely. It's turned out to be quite the opposite. I know 25 years ago when I graduated from medical school, I spent most of my time trying to figure out how to eradicate bacteria and germs. And it turns out that that's not such a great idea, because many of these organisms, not all, but many of them, are really essential for our own health, quite frankly, and their well-being is very much strongly tied to our own.
What do they do in our digestive tract?
So bacteria are responsible for a lot of different things in the digestive tract. Most importantly, they help to break down food so that we can absorb it. They produce digestive enzymes. They are intimately involved in the process of the bacteria breaking down the food and then the food passing through the intestinal membrane. They convert sugars to short-chain fatty acids for energy. They help our body absorb nutrients like calcium and iron. They synthesize some important vitamins like vitamin K, which is essential for clotting, that our body can't synthesize on our own. And a really fascinating example of that, Larry, is that when patients get admitted to the hospital who are quite sick and are on intravenous antibiotics, within a few days, they start to have clotting problems, and we have to give them doses of vitamin K, usually intravenously, and that's because the antibiotics kill off so much of the bacteria in the body that we end up being depleted of vitamin K because, again, bacteria are the ones that make it. So that's a great real-life example of how that works. They keep the pH balanced. They synthesize hormones. They metabolize drugs. They neutralize cancer-causing compounds. They train the immune system. They modulate genes. They do a lot. They are really our worker bees.
And we're not going to go very far without them, are we?
We are not going to go very far without them. In fact, the germ-free existence, we can do it with mice in the lab. They can live germ-free under very controlled conditions. But if we didn't have any bacteria, we would not be alive.
You know, as you said, you're traditionally trained. What happened? I think it's an interesting story about what happened to make you explore microbiomes.
So I, as you said, I'm conventionally trained. I trained at Yale and Columbia, and I did my GI training at Mount Sinai Hospital. And my area of interest and expertise is inflammatory bowel disease. And I had the great honor of being trained by a lot of fantastic people who actually, Dr. Crohn, who described Crohn's disease in 1932, trained. So it's a great tradition. But like many of the great traditions in medicine, we're very good at answering the question, what is this? But not so much, why is this happening? So we knew what a lot of these diseases, autoimmune diseases like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis were. But we never really came very close to answering the question, why? And I think this medical paradigm of disease that sort of falls from the sky into our laps, or it's all based in our genes, is really now being reevaluated through the prism of the microbiome. In my particular circumstance, about 11 and a half years ago, I was in the hospital in labor, giving birth to my lovely daughter, Sydney. And I was, other than what they call advanced maternal age, being in my late 30s, I was very healthy. But I ended up with an epidural because being in labor is painful, and I didn't know any better. So I got an epidural. That prolonged the labor. It ended up being a C-section. And I had the flu that year and a little bit of a fever from that, but was otherwise well. But because of my fever, just for precautionary reasons, they ended up putting my daughter in the neonatal ICU and doing a full, what we call sepsis workup, a full evaluation for infection in her, which was not inappropriate, but they also just preventatively put her on strong doses of intravenous antibiotics. And as a result of the prolonged labor and the epidural, I ended up with a C-section. So despite having trained at really good institutions, I was completely unaware of the difference in terms of the effects of the microbiome on a vaginal birth and a C-section. So I think it's worth stopping for a moment right there. If you've ever seen a delivery, and if you haven't, there's some great animations on the internet that show them in not too much detail, but you sort of get the picture. When the baby's head crowns, which is just as it starts to sort of exit from the vagina, the baby's head turns posteriorly. So why does it turn posteriorly? It turns to face the tush, and it turns to face posteriorly so the baby can swallow a mouthful of microbes from an area in the pelvis which is full of microbes, which is namely that area between the rectum and the vagina. We call it the perineum. And the baby swallows a mouthful of microbes as it enters the vaginal canal, the birth canal, as it exits. And that single act is one of the most important moments of our life, believe it or not, because that is when our microbiome becomes seeded with the beginnings of what our own microbiome will develop into, but we really get it from our mother. So babies born via C-section bypass that critical step. And in studies, what we find is that babies born by C-section, instead of being colonized with healthy lactobacillus and bifidobacteria and these other important early founding species, they are colonized with hospital-acquired staph and some not-so-desirable species. And these changes really have a long-term effect. So we know babies born by C-section are at higher risk for asthma, allergies, autoimmune diseases, obesity later on in life. So having this sort of lack of the founding species based on how you're born really has profound implications. And if you have the misfortune of not being breastfed, you're really missing out again, because the third most common ingredient in breast milk is something called human milk oligosaccharides, HMOs. And despite being the third most common ingredient in breast milk, they are completely indigestible by infants. So again, we would ask ourselves, why is something that's the third most common ingredient in breast milk something that the infants can't even digest? And that's because it's not there to feed the baby. It's there to feed the baby's bacteria, specifically the bifidobacterium that are present in high numbers in breastfed infants. And these HMOs feed the bifido, and the bifido in turn repels staphylococcus and other harmful microbes that are on the skin. So it's part of this microbial arsenal that the baby is developing. And again, even though over the years we've figured out missing ingredients in formula and we've added various things, DHA and so on, there's still many things like this HMOs that we're only becoming aware of that are important for the symbiosis between the baby's burgeoning microbiome and the baby's health and what's in the breast milk and so on. So we see very big differences between babies born by C-section versus vaginally breastfed versus bottle-fed with formula. And we see other changes too, like babies who are in large families, who have other siblings who are sneezing and coughing on them. This turns out to actually be a really good idea for developing the baby's immune system. But my own awakening came with this experience in the hospital, having a C-section, my daughter having multiple antibiotics at birth, and then entering into the cycle of repeated illness of, you know, starting at about 3 or 4 months old, she was just sick all the time. High fever, 104 degrees, ear infections, pharyngitis, all sorts of things. And by the time she was about 2, she'd been on 16 courses of antibiotics. Wow. And also had a hospitalization for rotavirus. So it was clear that her little immune system was struggling, and things that she should have been able to sort of overcome on her own, she couldn't, because, again, of this disadvantage of the C-section and and the heavy doses of antibiotics. And so it really took me a while to realize what was going on. And I tell you, it's really difficult for parents. And, you know, here I am a physician. I should have known. But it's so difficult when your small baby is crying inconsolably and has a high fever. You're scared and you're desperate. And a well-meaning physician says, oh, take this antibiotic and all will be better. And you believe it, and you do. And often it is, in terms of, you know, if it's a bacterial infection. But more often than not, we're treating viral infections that are self-limited. And quite frankly, antibiotics have no efficacy against viral infections. And what we're doing as a result of this is, unfortunately, we're decimating the microbiome, which, you know, 10 years ago, 11 years ago, I don't think anybody knew what the term was. It was in just sort of very small select circles that people talked about the microbiome, but it certainly hadn't penetrated into mainstream medical society. I was completely unaware of the fact that 5 days of a broad-spectrum antibiotic of the type my daughter was getting was removing a third of her gut bacteria.
Yeah.
And that it would take years to come back, and when it did, it was patchy and missing and so on. And this is now, Larry, what I see in my office. It is sort of an endless stream of people who have a history similar to hers, maybe not as dramatic at birth, but kids who have been treated repeatedly for strep. And one of the first things I ask about antibiotic use, but I ask specifically about tonsillectomy, because there's always a long lead up before you have a tonsillectomy. There's lots of antibiotics. Most ENT docs don't just yank out your tonsils the first time you have strep. It's usually the kid who's been treated repeatedly who ends up with tonsillectomy. So it's a bit of a marker for frequent antibiotic use. And kids have been treated for prolonged antibiotic use, sometimes years, for acne. And then in adults, it's the people with a chronic sinusitis who've been on this cycle of antibiotic use. And the lucky ones are just having gas and bloating and sort of abdominal discomfort. And the not-so-lucky ones, usually the ones with more extensive use, have sometimes developed autoimmune disease. So we know now that many autoimmune diseases, particularly the two I'm most familiar with, Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, have their origin in the gut. So it's this just fascinating interplay between our genes and environmental factors like the microbiome. So we know that there are about 100 different genes that will increase your risk for Crohn's disease, and we know certain ethnic groups have higher risk. So, for example, people of Ashkenazi Jewish descent tend to have more of the genes associated with Crohn's disease. But you can literally have all of them without some sort of environmental trigger. You're unlikely to develop Crohn's, and we know this from identical twin studies who have the same set of genes, the same DNA. And if something like Crohn's were purely a genetic disease, then we would expect the concordance in identical twins to be 100%. But it's not. It's somewhere closer to 50%. And the difference really is in the environmental factors. So many of the genes, like the NOD2 gene on chromosome 16 that code for Crohn's disease, what they cause is they cause an overreaction to normal gut flora. So it's basically a confused immune system. Instead of saying, oh, this is just normal bacteria in the colon, we don't have to worry, it mounts an immune response, and there's inflammation and ulceration and sometimes strictures and bleeding and all kinds of things go on. And it's basically the immune system treating normal bacteria of the gut as though it were the enemy, as though it were something invading. And that is really the basis for most autoimmune diseases, whether we're talking about the joints with rheumatoid arthritis or the brain with MS or the skin with psoriasis. It is an immune system that mm-hmm. is overreacting to normal tissue.
Wow.
And, a lot of this emanates from the gut. I mean, I know every medical specialist thinks their organ is the most important, but I'm here to tell you.
Okay. Dr. Robin Chutkan, our guest today, talking with us about healing your body from the inside out. Her latest book is called The Microbiome Solution. Callers online already, but you can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hope you'll stay with us. Coming up at 11:45, we'll talk about getting the most out of your local farmers markets and tell you about an event that celebrates Wisconsin farms and farm women and rural life. That next. Right now, talking with Dr. Robin Chutkan, who is the author of The Microbiome Solution, a radical new way to heal your body from the inside out. Lots of callers online, Dr. Chutkan. I want to give Rick in Ironwood, Michigan, a chance to join in. Rick, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hello, good morning. Very interesting show. I was wondering, Doctor, are there advantages to a vegetarian diet? Because I've done one for 40 years, lacto-ovo. I eat dairy products and eggs and such. But I seem to be pretty healthy for a 65-year-old. Something must be working.
Rick, thank you so much for your question. And absolutely, you are definitely onto something. There are huge advantages to a plant-based diet. And that's because the number one food for what I like to call growing a good gut garden, encouraging the growth of this healthy bacteria that keep us healthy, is indigestible plant fiber. So it's basically the kind of fiber, the stringy fiber that's in things like asparagus and celery and leeks and onion and garlic and oats and lentils, and it sounds like you've been eating lots of that. So a vegetarian diet is a great way to do that. And at the same time, eating some animal protein like you do in terms of some products, you said you're lactovarian, so you have milk and eggs, is fine too. It's less about, I mean, there are other reasons people choose to be vegetarian or vegan, but from a health point of view, it's less about never eating any meat, and it's more about eating lots and lots of plants. But the reality is that for most people, the meat crowds out the vegetables, and the vegetables end up being garnish. So one way to really make sure you're getting enough plants is to say, you know what, I'm going to really only eat plants, or mostly plants, and that way you don't have to worry about the crowding out. So the dietary changes are key, and I tell patients all the time, I say, you know, I wish I could make this sexier, but eat more plants is my basic advice to you.
There we go, Rick. Thanks a lot for calling. Tom in Eau Claire has a question. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was just kind of interested in the correlation that the doctor had mentioned with antibiotics and the digestive tract. I was wondering if there were any other studies as far as antibiotics and the correlation to the uptick in allergies.
It's a great question, Tom, and there really are. And I don't know whether you're my generation, born in the 60s or earlier or later, but I'll tell you, when I was a kid in school, I think there was one kid in the whole school with a peanut allergy, and, you know, we all knew who he was. It was so rare. And nowadays, it's rare to not have a kid in your class with allergies. In fact, I don't think there are. I think the latest statistic is something like, you know, 4 out of 10 or something really amazing in terms of allergies, and not just seasonal allergies, but food allergies. And there actually is very good correlation, because I talked earlier about the gut bacteria helping to train the immune system to say, okay, this you need to worry about and react to. This you can ignore. This is sort of benign. This in too many large numbers could be problematic. But it's sort of air traffic control for our immune system. And where when we're not exposed to enough germs, our immune system goes kind of crazy. And that's a lot of what's happening with some of these allergies. So there are lots of studies in the pediatric literature looking at an increase in allergies the higher the amount of antibiotics that kids are exposed to. And it's part of my mantra of live dirty, is that you've got to let your kids get a little bit dirty. Play in the dirt, eat food that has dirt on it, get sneezed on, catch a cold. It's all fine. We don't want them to catch, you know, deadly diseases. But this sort of super sanitizing our kids, every time I see a kid with a hand sanitizer hanging off the back of their backpack, it makes me want to cry a little bit, because parents want the best for their kids. And somehow we have been misguided into thinking that the best is clean, and it's not. There's such a thing as too clean, and we've definitely gotten there.
Thanks again, Tom, for calling. Roger in Willow Glen up next. Hi, Roger. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I guess if I would have listened to the program, maybe I'd get all the answers. But I was prescribed Z-Pak for every 30 days for quite a long time, years, to try to counteract chronic sinusitis, because of a secondary effect of the Z-Pak is to dry the sinuses and also to kill bacteria. Sometimes it takes a couple doses of Z-Pak to kill bacteria in the sinuses. I haven't been taking a Z-Pak for a couple of years, and I don't think that my acute infections have got any worse. In fact, I think it's been better.
Roger.
How long is it going to take to get my gut back to normal?
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And I, again, remembering that statistic that 5 days of a broad spectrum antibiotic can remove up to a third of your gut bacteria, you've been having this Z-Pak every 30 days for years. And you have figured out what a lot of physicians have not figured out, which is the Z-Pak is not making you better. In fact, it might be making you worse. And part of that, there are two big reasons for that. Number one, many people who have chronic sinus infections have overgrowth of yeast species in the sinuses. Now, as women, we know this because when we take antibiotics over and over and over, we get vaginal yeast infections. And it's very clear what's going on. We get a, not to be too graphic, but we get a sort of creamy white discharge, and it's itchy and really unpleasant, and we know exactly what's going on, which is why many doctors in women will prescribe an antifungal with the antibiotic because they know what's going to happen. We're somehow less aware of that in the sinuses, but it's the same thing that goes on in the sinuses. And in fact, a study from a couple years ago showed that upwards of 90% of people with chronic sinusitis, like you've had, Roger, are colonized with yeast in the sinuses. And what they're really, what are part of what's contributing to the symptoms is this yeast colonization. The studies also show that people with chronic sinusitis have much less diversity of bacteria in their sinuses because so much of the bacteria have been killed off with antibiotics. And when you have a less diverse microbiome, whether it's in your gut or your sinuses or vaginally on your skin, you end up with problems. So that's a big part of it, is less diversity and yeast overgrowth. The other big thing to know is that many sinus infections are viral. So the antibiotics aren't efficacious at all, but unfortunately what happens is you get an antibiotic, you're not better. They give you usually a second dose of the same antibiotic, you're not better. Then they give you a stronger antibiotic, you're not better. And they give you yet another antibiotic, and then finally you're better because the infection has run its course. But in the meantime, a lot of bad things have happened to your microbiome. So we're in this odd time in medicine now where actually the consumers know a lot more about this than the medical community. And part of it is because as physicians, we're very resistant to the idea that something that we're doing might be causing a problem. Mm-hmm. We all take this oath, primum non nocere, above all, do no harm. It's part of the Hippocratic Oath. We've been trained and taught and to some extent indoctrinated to believe that drugs cure disease and that antibiotics cure infection. And it's very difficult for us to let go of that and to accept that maybe these things will get better on their own, maybe a change in diet will help, and also maybe what we're treating with is actually part of the problem. And I firmly believe that most physicians want the same thing. We want our patients to get better. We want good health for our patients, but we're still a little misinformed, unfortunately, as a community in terms of the fallout of some of these methods of treating.
Thank you, Roger, for calling. Appreciate it. Maybe at this point it'd be a good idea for you to explain how your book, The Microbiome Solution, is organized. Talk about it a little bit.
Sure. So as you'd mentioned, Larry, my motivation for writing this book was really my own experience with my daughter and also seeing the many, many Crohn's patients and other patients with autoimmune diseases who had this common thread of really significant antibiotic use. And it coincided with, you know, when I was researching the book a few years ago, there were a couple articles on the microbiome per month. Now there's several a day. I mean, it's fascinating and looking at other areas too, like Parkinson's and MS and autism and all the other areas where it's seeing the microbiome potentially plays a role. So I divided it up really into three sections. The first is sort of what the microbiome is and how this all works. What do our bacteria do? Why are they so important for our health? And really starting from birth, infancy, adulthood, all the way through, and sort of the role of bacteria in our lives. Then the second part talks about how it gets disrupted and what I like to call microbial disruptors. So things in the food, in the environment, in the medicine cabinet, all the different things that can mess up our microbiome. And then the third part is the solution part. So there's a chapter on choosing a probiotic. There's a chapter on diet. There's a chapter on a rewilding approach to illness, some alternatives to use for sinus infections, for acne, for urinary tract infections, for common infectious things, some alternatives to antibiotics. And That's essentially the organization, which is very similar to how I approach it in the office with patients.
Well, and I tell you what, you've got some good recipes in the back of the book.
Oh, thank you. The recipes, yes. A big shout out to my recipe creator, Elise Musellis from Kalen Chocolate. Yes, the food is fantastic.
Yeah, I'm a big ice cream guy, and I saw this Live Dirty, Eat Clean ice cream with bananas and probiotics, and it sounded pretty darn good.
Yeah, it is really good. You can mix it up in a Vitamix or blender. You don't even need an ice cream maker.
We have Karen from Menasha emailed to say that she is living with osteoarthritis and fibromyalgia. She takes three different types of pain medications every day, but she's at the point where they don't do much to control her pain. She fears the next step is an opioid medication, which she wants to avoid. Can you suggest foods or supplements, something that will reduce the inflammation?
Well, Karen, I'm so sorry to hear about your struggles. I know both of these conditions can be really debilitating. In terms of osteoarthritis, there's not a lot with the microbiome, but with fibromyalgia, there is. And I really try not to oversell the microbiome. So I, for some of these conditions that I'm less familiar with, there is definitely research and there is a role, but it might not completely reverse things. But at the end of the day, it's worth a try because most of the things, in fact, all of the things I'm suggesting are things that are going to make you healthier overall. And if they can decrease your dependence on the pain medication or allow you to not go on an opioid, they would be great. So the dietary recommendations are in the book. I think it's chapter 9 on the Live Dirty diet. And I'll kind of summarize it for you. So we take out some of the processed food and the sugary and starchy stuff that we know leads to overgrowth of the wrong type of bacteria. So there is still some sweet stuff in there. You can use raw organic honey as a sweetener, but we take out most of the sugar and the very starchy things. There's still really great carbohydrates you can eat, like brown rice and quinoa and things like squash and sweet potato and so on, but we take out most of the white foods, like the white potato, the white rice, the bread, the pasta, that kind of stuff. And as much as we focus on what we remove, we focus even more on what we add in. And as we discussed with our vegetarian caller, Rick, earlier, we really try and make sure you're eating enough indigestible plant fiber. Because even if we give you a very robust probiotic, like the one I use in my practice, which is 900 billion live bacteria, if you're not feeding them the right food, they're not going to stick around and repopulate your gut and recolonize and really be able to do any good. So it's important that you're making the dietary changes. There's a very easy formula I use for vegetables, and it's called my 1-2-3 rule. So eat one vegetable in the morning, two at lunch, three at dinner. And even if you don't get out all the bad stuff, if you reintroduce a lot of the good stuff, I think it will really help. A vegetable in the morning might be some spinach with your eggs, or in my case, I like to make a green smoothie with a couple different green vegetables and maybe a little bit of berries or green apple for sweetness. At lunch, it could be some roasted vegetables or a salad. And for dinner, trying to get three vegetables in, I always try and do a salad with a couple vegetables in it as well as another vegetable on the side. And that's really key. So it's less about whether you're having a piece of chicken or not, and more about whether you are having enough plants. And that's what I really try and get people to focus on.
You mentioned breakfast, and I one of the recipes I'm going to try in your book is sweet potato and kale breakfast hash. That sounded
delicious.
Sounded really good to me.
It's good, and you can put an egg. You can put in a little bit of sausage if you'd like to. Absolutely.
Oh boy, Buck in Green Bay. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Boy, I tell you, I just got to, first of all, I'll tell everybody that your guest is on the money. I mean, I'm going to tell you what happened to me. I'm almost 50, and I was about 42. I started having some real bad intestinal problems, and there was a lot of testing involved and a lot of expense, and I was very frustrated, and I finally was able to meet with a dietitian from the local hospital. And she single-handedly, well, not single-handedly because everybody else was involved first, but she saved my life in the end. She had to sit me down and teach me how to eat food. And I'll just tell everybody, this goes out to all the guys out there who are dads. You're working. I'm a tradesman. I was drinking three cans of Coke a day. I didn't smoke, so I was eating two or three candy bars, didn't eat vegetables. You know, I mean, I just had a terrible diet. I wasn't overweight, but I wasn't healthy in the stomach like she says. So, you know, the sugar and the caffeine, I was drinking a lot of coffee, and, you know, it just took its toll. I mean, I had some very bad stomach problems, and I was frustrated. I couldn't get to where I had to go, and I didn't know how. So I gotta learn how to eat. And I found this dietitian on my own. I went and saw her, and she said, here's what I want you to eat for 2 weeks. Don't do anything else, and then call me in 2 weeks. But don't call me until 2 weeks are up. Well, after like 3 days, I felt amazing. So I cold turkey quit soda, coffee, alcohol. I mean, it was hard. You know, I went through withdrawal. I got the headaches, didn't feel happy. And then all of a sudden, I started going, I can feel my stomach didn't have the pain in it. I started feeling better. So I didn't call her for 2 weeks, like she said. And she said, you know, nobody calls me after 2 weeks because very few people stick to it. And so now it's my annual routine. I call her after the first year, and we celebrate that, you know, I found the way. And now I'm at the point in my life where I can enjoy my coffee. You know, her message is all things in moderation once you're healthy. So now I can drink coffee. I can have alcohol with my buddies and drink beer if I want. But I don't drink soda. I don't eat candy bars. As I'm driving in my truck listening to you, I'm munching on my veggie bag that my wife packed.
Oh, I love it.
And I'm telling you guys, it's hard to see yourself doing it. But if you do it, you'll sleep better. You can work harder and feel better at the end of a day. You're happier. I mean, at age 50, I'm in better health than I was when I was 40, by far.
It's just a fantastic story. Thank you so much for sharing it. And, you know, the point it really emphasizes, too, is that physicians don't have a lot of this information, and I kind of hate to not my specialty, but a lot of this information, you know, people are getting from their yoga instructors and dietitians and herbalists and acupuncturists, and that's because they don't teach you anything about this in medical school. They don't teach you about how to eat, and, you know, many physicians themselves are unhealthy, so it's fantastic. I mean, physicians are great, and my gastroenterology colleagues are wonderful for certain things, but dietary advice is not usually high on the list. So it's great that you sought out a dietitian. I'm a big fan of dietitians and health coaches and other people who really have the information. And as you said, you dove in and you did it, and you can't argue with success. Within 3 days, you felt better. And that three-day mark is really interesting, and I'll tell you what's going on there, Buck. There's a great study from Harvard where they took about 9 volunteers, and they put them on an Atkins-type high-fat, high-protein, low-fiber diet. It was pork rinds and pastrami and, you know, that kind of stuff, and cheese. And after they looked at the microbiome before, during, and after, and then they rested them for about a week, and they put the same volunteers on a plant-based diet with jasmine rice and lentils and mangoes and pineapple. I mean, nothing too crazy, plants mostly, some rice. What they found was that in about 36 hours, so right about the three-day mark you talk about, the gut bacteria started to change dramatically, and we started to see a shift away from the bile-loving, the bilophilic bacteria that are associated with breaking down a lot of fat and protein and are associated with inflammation and obesity towards bacteria that are associated with leanness and health. And what's more fascinating, Buck, is that not only did the gut bacteria start to change, but the genes that were turned on and off also started to change. So one of the things I love about working in this area is it is such a message of optimism. You know, unlike this fatalistic, well, it's my genes, my grandpa had it, my dad had it, I'm going to get it, we can change our microbiome in as little as 3 days. And in fact, the microbiome that you wake up with tomorrow is different already from the microbiome you went to bed with tonight. And we can change it. How do we change it? We change it through judiciously avoiding antibiotics whenever we can, through eating really good organic food, ideally that's been produced locally, has a little dirt on it when you buy it, and eating more plants. You know, these really simple things. There are lots more tips in the book, like opening window and getting a pet and so on. But there's some really basic ones. And again, I just want to congratulate you, Buck, and good for you for spreading the word.
And thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Thomas posted on Facebook to ask what you think of milk kefir for your gut flora.
So I love the concept of kefir, or some people call it kefir, which is a fermented product. But the problem is it's only as good as the milk you're using. And we know that a lot of the milk that we're using, that we have access to in the U.S., has antibiotics in it, has growth hormone in it, it has various other hormones in it. And it's also pasteurized, which means that it is heated to a very high temperature to remove potentially harmful bacteria. And then the temperatures drop. So it doesn't on its own have much health benefits in terms of bacteria. And, you know, you just have to be clear that you're getting antibiotic and hormone-free milk. You can also make kefir with things like coconut milk and other non-dairy things if you prefer that. But fermented foods like kefir, sauerkraut, kimchi, just fermenting vegetables is a great way to improve your microbiome. And the way that works is if you take something like sauerkraut, which is fermented cabbage, cabbage itself is a food that's high in fiber. So it's going to provide a lot of food for your bacteria. It's what we call a prebiotic. It's providing the fibrous food to feed your existing gut bacteria. But in the fermentation process, when you cut up the cabbage and you put it in a little salt and water and you brine it and you let it ferment, that produces lactobacillus, one of the really essential bacteria for the gut. So when you then eat that sauerkraut, not only are you getting the fiber to feed your existing gut bacteria, you're also getting additional bacteria that you're introducing into your GI system. So it's kind of like a twofer.
Oh, that's wonderful. How's the book doing, by the way?
The book is doing really well, I have to say. And of my three books, I hope my publishers at Penguin won't be mad, but it's by far my favorite. I just feel so good about this book because I feel like it provides people with really useful information. It doesn't oversell the microbiome, but it points out a lot of things that we're doing that are creating problems for us and for our families. And, you know, I think if I'm a physician who trained at really good institutions and didn't know a lot of this stuff, chances are a lot of people in the community don't know. And, yeah, I'm really proud of the book and really excited to spread the message. And I love hearing from people who've had a microbial transformation, if you will.
Well, Dr. Chutkan, I'm taking your book home to keep, and I'm going to be trying some of those recipes as well. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us again. I hope we have a chance to visit again.
I hope so. Thank you so much for having me on, Larry.
Dr. Robin Chutkan is an integrative gastroenterologist. She's the founder of the Digestive Center for Women, teaches at Georgetown University Hospital, and is the author of three books, Gut Bliss, The Bloat Cure, and her latest book, The Microbiome Solution, A Radical New Way to Heal Your Body from the Inside Out. And you know what? I really will be taking that the book home to keep. And I think our show coming up is a great addition to this particular show, because we're going to be talking about sustainable agriculture, organic agriculture. We're going to be talking about going to farmers markets and what to do when you get to a farmers market. That coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.